Welcome to Talking History. This is Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. The newspapers have been filled recently with stories about the involvement of German industry with the Third Reich. Such involvement has had its defenders as well as its critics, but it certainly has raised some interesting questions as to the extent to which business as usual is possible in the face of crimes against humanity. This is the subject of today's show and Eileen Dugan's conversation with Neil Greger, author of Daimler-Benz in the Third Reich. But before we get to that, let's look back at a key event from this week in history. During this week in 1934, famed American bank robber John Dillinger was shot and killed outside a Chicago theater. Beginning his life of crime as the son of a grocer in Indianapolis, the young Dillinger's favorite school subject seemed to be schoolyard fights. Joining the Navy in 1923, Dillinger was dishonorably discharged for absence without leave, and over the next 10 years, his rebellious criminal nature led him in and out of jail for crimes committed across the Midwest. In January of 1934, while in jail in Indiana for the murder of a policeman, Dillinger made a toy gun out of chiseled wood and black shoe polish. 2 months later, he successfully threatened guards with the toy escaping the law yet again. While celebrating his 31st birthday in Chicago with a prostitute and a sage, Dillinger failed to realize that Sage had turned state's evidence and notified the Chicago police of his whereabouts. On July 22, 1934, while walking out of the Biograph Theater, Dillinger was fatally wounded by police gunfire. Turning to items of historical interest in the news, few people realize that the casket used to transport President John Kennedy's body from Dallas to Washington is not the same casket he is buried in today. This is just one of the many findings revealed in the latest flood of official documents made available to the public by the John F. Kennedy Assassination Records Collection Act of 1992. Evidently, the original Kennedy casket was damaged in transit, and when JFK's body was transferred to another casket, the family asked that the original be dumped into the Atlantic Ocean. And in a recent visit to his native Poland, John Paul II used Copernicus's revolutionary scientific findings of the 16th century to discuss the current relationship between faith and reason. While Copernicus was right to use scientific means in order to discover a truth contrary to church teaching, the Pope explained, it's important today for societies worldwide not to lose their faith in a sea of growing technological advances. To quote him directly, although Copernicus himself saw his discovery as giving rise to even greater amazement at the creator of the world and the power of human reason, many people took it as a means of setting reason against faith. You're listening to Talking History. Historians have uncovered some troubling information about the relationship of German industry to the Third Reich. One of the sources of that information is historian Neil Greger, and here to talk to Professor Greger about his research is Talking History's Eileen Dugan.
Among the many disturbing themes of the Oscar-winning film Schindler's List was its portrayal of the deals that were often made between the Nazis and German industrialists, often trading forced laborers for lucrative government contracts. Indeed, recent scholarship on World War II has begun to reveal a pervasive pattern of collusion between big business and the Nazis. Some might have called it dancing with the devil. Others would have simply justified it all as good business. With us today to discuss the relationship between German industry and the Nazi regime is Dr. Neil Greger, lecturer in modern German history at the University of Southampton in England. Dr. Greger is the author of the recent book, Daimler-Benz in the Third Reich. Welcome, Dr. Greger.
Hello.
Now, why haven't we heard much before about the relationship between Daimler-Benz and the Nazis?
Well, it's a complex question. There are a number of things to say there. I think we have to go back, first of all, right to the end of the war and the context of the emerging Cold War. I think it's well known that the Cold War itself helped to shape many myths about the Third Reich, above all the dominant image of the Nazi period, which was used in the Cold War period, was that of the totalitarian regime. It served the function, obviously, partly of re-legitimating liberal democracy in the 50s and 60s, but it also, I think, helped to re-legitimate capitalism in Europe in the immediate aftermath of the Second World War. Capitalism itself had been through a period of protracted crisis, if you like, in the interwar period in Europe. And German big business was itself instrumental in embarking upon a big propaganda war, if you like, in the late 40s and 50s, trying to help write the history of the Nazi era in a way in which its own complicity in the narrative of Nazi criminality was erased, if you like. It sponsored a lot of brochures and leaflets and popular books claiming that business had been forced into the various things which it had done, and it was very successful, I think, as a public relations strategy. And that fits, if you like, with a general pattern of understating the complicity of the conservative elites in the crimes of the Third Reich. And it's really only in the 1980s that that started to change. And there are several reasons for that, too. I think, firstly, we have to say that it was only in the 1980s that scholarship on the Third Reich started to focus on the war period rather than the pre-war period. And so the whole issue of slave labor and forced labor came to the fore in a way that it hadn't before. There were a couple of very influential books appeared in the mid-80s, above all that of Ulrich Herbert, which really opened the subject up. And, of course, from the end of the Cold War meant that all those survivors of forced labor who had not been able to campaign for compensation because of the Cold War suddenly found themselves in a position to do so. And I think that awoke public interest. So it's really the end of the Cold War, I think, as much as anything, which has opened the subject up.
Now, as a point of reference to our discussion of Daimler-Benz, which is the subject of your book, when did the Nazis realize the benefits of a close relationship with industry?
Well, even before they came to power, I think, despite the anti-capitalist rhetoric of Hitler's early speeches, they realized that they were going to need the support, or at least cooperation, of big business. And, of course, there were aspects of the Nazi program which big business very much sympathized with, above all the anti-Republican agenda, the anti-democratic agenda, and the anti-Marxist, anti-socialist, anti-trade union agenda of the Nazis appealed to many business people, even those who might not have chosen to support the Nazis above other right-wing parties. From the Nazis' point of view, of course, they were going to need the businessmen to help them rearm and to re-equip the German armed forces and to help operate eventually a war economy. So there were kind of communities of interest, if you like, which both business, or sectors of business at least, and the Nazis were aware of.
Well, between Volkswagen and Daimler-Benz, it would appear that the Nazis were very interested in the automobile sector.
Yeah.
And you know, was it more than simply cars that Daimler-Benz was involved in?
Oh, absolutely. I think it's important to remember that in the First World War, the two companies which went to make Daimler-Benz, the Daimler Motor Company and Benz & Co., as they were then, they merged in 1926, they'd both been very key armaments producers in the First World War. So they had a pre-existing body of expertise in producing armaments, which were then or was then really reactivated, if you like, in 1933, and actually to a certain extent before. It always was, if you like, a mixed concern. And of course, the 1930s, once the Nazis came to power, offered the company possibilities to expand their armaments-orientated production facilities. So they moved quite easily, if you like, from producing primarily cars and trucks for commercial markets to producing military versions of these. And on top of that, they were able to convert their motor manufacturing capacity to manufacturing aircraft engines too, and naval engines too. So it was actually very easy for a company like this to move in a very flexible fashion from one to another.
So how many factories are we talking about in terms of Daimler-Benz?
Well, in 1933, there were four core factories in South Germany, which still exist today, in Stuttgart, in Sindelfingen, in Mannheim, and there was another one which I forget at the moment, in Gaggenau, that's it. And in addition, there was one in Berlin. Now, over the course of the 1930s, additional factories were gradually established. One was established just outside Berlin, which by the outbreak of war became the biggest aero engine producing facility in Germany. Another one was established in East Prussia, in what is now Kaliningrad. And then, of course, in the war, Daimler-Benz expanded into the whole of Europe. As countries that were occupied by the Nazi army, by the Nazi regime, they integrated the plants of the economies of the occupied territories into their war machine too. And they used industrialists from Germany to operate those. And so by the end of the war, Daimler-Benz was operating plants in Poland, in Czechoslovakia, in Hungary, in France. It had links with plants in Italy, and so on. Really, an enormous production network across the whole of Europe by the end of the war.
That must have taken an enormous labor force. So where did they get their labor? Was it forced labor, slave labor?
Yes, absolutely. Every German company exploited forced and slave labor, and Daimler-Benz was no exception here. By the end of the war, about half of their workforce in some plants comprised of forced or slave labor. In some workshops, it was 60 or 70%. Obviously, those workers in the occupied territories were exploited on the basis of forced labor. They had very little choice, and they were exploited in a completely appalling fashion. But we also have to recognize that workers were deported from all over Europe to work in the factories in Germany too, and Daimler-Benz was no exception there. The workforce of the core German plants, those which still exist today too, was saturated with forced laborers by the end of the war.
And how would you define those who were forced into labor apart from those in the occupied land? Were they concentration camp inhabitants or what?
Well, you get a huge variety, and these people were deployed according to the racial hierarchy which Nazi ideology defined. The situation was such that by the outbreak of the war, the German economy was already suffering from huge shortages of labor because of the big expansion of economic activity in the 30s. And initially, foreign workers were recruited primarily from Western Europe in almost a continuity with pre-existing traditions of labor migration, and it gradually became more and more coercive, more and more compulsive. And the big turning point then was the winter of 1941 to 1942, following the attack on the Soviet Union. Following that, huge numbers of Soviet prisoners of war and Soviet civilians were captured and deported and put to work in Germany's factories under absolutely appalling conditions, inhumane, barbaric, and exploitative. And that then, if you like, paved the way for an even further descent into a kind of culture of barbaric labor policy when, towards the end of the war, as the labor shortages became even more acute, concentration camp inmates were also put to work in many factories, with the acceptance and connivance, it must be emphasized, of the business people themselves. So that at Daimler-Benz, you had workers from Dachau, the concentration camp near Munich, workers from Ravensbrück, the camp near Berlin, and a whole host of other camps working in their thousands under really brutal conditions in Daimler-Benz's factories, and many died, and many more were treated in such a way that they suffered from long-term damage to their health.
How much freedom of maneuver did the bosses of Daimler-Benz have in running their company? Were they able to make decisions themselves, or did they always have to consult the Nazi government first?
Well, the Third Reich is a very complicated place, as the world is in general, and it's impossible to say either that they had full freedom of maneuver or that they had none whatsoever. The truth is somewhere in between. After the war, of course, as we were talking about earlier, business fell back on the myth of the totalitarian state, the notion that it had been forced into producing armaments forced into utilizing forced slave labor and concentration camp labor and so on, that it had not wanted to do this and had no choice. The reality, of course, is somewhat different. By and large, it welcomed the destruction of democracy, it welcomed arms contracts, and it welcomed the huge expansion of economic activity the Nazi regime generated. Now, by the war, I think it's fair to say that many industrialists had some misgivings about the growing interventionism of the Nazi regime and over the speed of rearmament, but they still carried on. The point here being that any concerns I think they might have had were smoothed by the huge profits they were making. So it seems to me that if we want to understand the relationship between the Nazi regime and big business, we should be speaking not the language of coercion that one forced the other, but really the language of complicity, of collusion, of collaboration, if not using the language of cooperation. There were tensions there, but there were also substantial communities of interest. I think on the subject of forced labor, we also have to emphasize that business had some room for maneuver. If you go from company to company and look at how their forced workers were treated, you can see that there are differences from company to company. That in itself, I think, speaks for the fact that businesses had certain room for maneuver in how they treated these workers. It wasn't just that they were forced to do so by the Nazi regime. Some companies really operated more willingly along the racist lines of the Nazi regime than others. And I think it's fair to say that Daimler-Benz was one of the worst companies in this respect.
How badly damaged were the Daimler-Benz plants by the end of the war?
Well, of course, our standard images, if you like, of Germany in 1945 are those of huge physical damage of rubble and of life in the rubble, especially for the female population of Germany. Now, the reality is that by the time the huge bombing attacks occurred on Germany's cities, many industrial factories had been relocated outside of the main urban centers. They'd moved their production lines into empty factories outside the cities, or they had moved them to underground caves, which had also been dug out by concentration camp inmates, slave workers provided by the SS. And by cooperating in this brutal exploitation of concentration camp labor to dig out these caves, companies like Daimler-Benz were able to relocate a great amount of their machinery underground, which meant, of course, that it survived the bombing. And after the war, they just had to move it back to their factories once they were rebuilt. And as a result, I think less than 20% of Daimler-Benz's machine stock was destroyed during the war. The continuities are much stronger than the images of rubble might suggest. Let's put it like that.
Well, that's certainly amazing. Now, some people in the U.S. who are aware of Daimler-Benz's association with the Nazis were rather alarmed when they heard of the car maker's merger with Chrysler last year. We only have a moment remaining, but what advice would you give viewers, say a PR man for Daimler-Benz or Daimler-Chrysler, what advice would you give them in terms of handling this potential public relations powder keg?
Well, I think the first point to make is that that's their problem, not mine. I don't believe that this merger should be stopped on account of the past experiences and past behavior of German big business in the Nazi era. I don't think that's the right way to make the points about the past and to keep those points alive. If, as a result of this merger, in the United States, discussion takes place of the past of Daimler-Benz in a way that keeps the memory of the Nazi past alive in American society and fosters awareness and understanding, then that in itself will be a positive thing for now and for the future. The important thing is that before the survivors of slave labor die, and of course this generation is dying out now, the important thing is that companies like Daimler-Benz and the rest of German industry pay adequate compensation and make an adequate statement of moral contrition and humility.
Well, thank you, Dr. Greger.
Thank you very much.
We have been talking with Dr. Neil Greger, lecturer at the University of Southampton in England and author of Daimler-Benz in the Third Reich.
Following on our conversation with Neil Greger on German industry during the Third Reich, Robert Brent Toplin is here to offer his views on how NATO actions recently taken in Kosovo differed from Allied responses to German ethnic cleansing in the late 1930s. Toplin is a professor of history at the University of North Carolina at Wilmington. His op-ed comes to us courtesy of the History News Service.
Back in the 70s, a politician complained about nattering nabobs of negativism. His terminology seems more relevant to the political scene today. Negative nabobs have been complaining long and hard about our military intervention in Yugoslavia. When the bombing began a few months ago, they protested, saying the war was a big mistake. They said NATO should have negotiated longer with Slobodan Milosevic. They also warned that bombing from the air without action by ground troops could not work. It never had in modern history, they reminded us. Furthermore, the war was not in the United States' interest. Yugoslavia, that pit of ethnic hatred, was not worth a single American or NATO life, said these critics of military action. A commitment to war could also wreck NATO and destroy U.S. credibility in foreign affairs. Moreover, said the critics, it could lead the United States into new entanglements in many other places in the world where civil wars and ethnic strife threaten lives and political stability. The naysayers also blame the United States and NATO for the violent expulsion of Kosovars. Bombing provoked Serbian atrocities, they said. Now the war has ended, but these jeremiads continue. Patrick Buchanan says the policy was badly mistaken, and Henry Kissinger warns that American actions have badly harmed relations with Russia and China. With all this pessimistic talk about the consequences of NATO's engagement in the Balkans, you would think that Slobodan Milosevic won the fight. Let's get a life. Can't we feel good about the results of this military action? Can't we congratulate ourselves not only for an undertaking that was effective as military action, but also for doing, as we say, the right thing? Consider the upside. Most important, the United States and NATO succeeded in taking a bold humanitarian stand. Milosevic's army and paramilitary henchmen had slaughtered other Balkan peoples in the 90s, as well as the Kosovars. They were at their game again when NATO intervened. This time, unlike the horrible days of the late 30s and early 40s, when the United States did practically nothing in response to news about German anti-Semitic acts, the United States took a long, strong, and controversial stand against ethnic cleansing. NATO sent a clear message that applies to the region of its primary involvement, the madness of ethnic hatred that brought so much violence to Europe in the 20th century must stop. Every other European nation has joined in the new spirit of peaceful economic and political cooperation. That compact of civility now must apply to Yugoslavia as well. The nattering nabobs of negativism insist that cultural hatreds in the Balkans are too deep-rooted to be cleaned up by NATO's actions. But the Germans and other Europeans boiled with ethnic and national hostility until the end of World War II. Today they partake effectively in that compact of civility. Perhaps human nature is not so unchangeable after all. This is a proud moment. America and her European allies stood up for humanity in words and in deeds. Can we at least savor the victory for a few days?
You've been listening to Robert Brent Toplin, professor of history at the University of North Carolina at Wilmington, and this is Talking History. Welcome back to Talking History. For our recommended historic site of the week, we're sending you back to New England and to a simpler time and people. Here to describe our site of the week is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
New Hampshire is home to two restored Shaker villages, The Shaker Inn at the Great Stone Dwelling in Enfield, New Hampshire, is a massive 160-year-old granite structure and is the centerpiece for the Enfield Shaker Village, which also includes a museum that offers all kinds of activities for families. The Canterbury Shaker Village, which is about an hour from Enfield, is a private nonprofit historic site consisting of 24 original buildings on 694 acres. Both sites were originally built by the sect known as Shakers that once numbered 6,000 in communities from Maine to Kentucky.
Thank you, Cindy. Turning to our weekly segment, Coming Attractions, Mount Rainier National Park in Washington State turns 100 this year, and it will celebrate its centennial with a series of activities, including exhibits, festivals, and a 60-mile summit-to-sound relay from the top of Rainier to Puget Sound by foot, bicycle, rollerblade, horseback, and kayak. But if you prefer the city, try the American Century Art and Culture 1900 to 2000 exhibit at the Whitney Museum of American Art in New York City. The exhibit, which runs through August 22nd, features more than 1,200 paintings, sculptures, and photographs. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed our program and that you'll join us next week for our show on Islamic fundamentalism. In the meantime, we invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History Care of the Department of History at Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. Until next time, from the studios of KIOS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau. Thank you.